Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Who really rules the world, and what sort of job are they doing? My guest today argues that it boils down to about 6,000 very wealthy people in fields from politics to finance to entertainment who tend to run in the same highly insular circles and exercise great influence over how the other 6 billion of us live. David Rothkopf is a visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His new book is called Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. David, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you basically find that these people are quite literally one in a million. What qualifies somebody as a member of the superclass?
Well, I wanted to look at global power and how global power is changing, and so we needed a definition that would define the highest level. And what I came up with was people who influence millions of lives across borders on a regular basis. And so if you meet those three criteria, you can get in. And so you could be a CEO of a big company, you could be a big investor, you might be the head of a government, you might be a rock star, you might be the Pope, you could even be a terrorist. And so it's quite a diverse group. It's not a monolithic group. They don't all meet together in one place and plan out things. But they are set apart from everybody else because they're the most powerful and they're operating on a global stage.
How does their power compare with traditional structures, someone who would say the leader of a country?
Well, the leader of a country is linked to the country. They are tied by national sovereignty to their borders. The influence that they may have is over people within that country. But even that's decreasing. You know, it used to be that a country that wanted to change the way companies behaved would write a law. But since the companies are global, they can say, well, if you change your law, we're going someplace else. Or we got a better offer from another country. And so the leverage that national leaders have is declining in the face of the way truly multinational players can play.
So what sort of influence do members of the superclass have over each other?
Well, it depends. And, you know, you bring up a good point, because even though this is the most sort of concentrated group of power that you could imagine, within it there are some people who have more power. The key power I think a lot of these people have is what you might call the power of asset allocation. You know, you've got billions of dollars, or you've got resources or people, and you can deploy them to support your priorities. Well, if you're a big investor, you can help shape how much that big CEO gets paid. So that's one form of influence. If you're a big CEO, you can determine how much money your company gives to fight a political initiative. So that's another kind of leverage. And so each one of them has a different kind of power over the others.
One thing that is shocking and, to my mind, disturbing is how similar these members of the superclass, these 6,000, tend to be to each other. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think it's a little disturbing because, you know, we come from a tradition where we believe that government should be representative of the people. Well, for example, 94% of this superclass, the 6,000 as we looked at them, are men. Well, women are the majority of population on Earth. So what's going on there? And you know, we've had 30 years of sort of a revolution to give women more of a role. But still to this day, only 17% of legislatures around the world are women. Only 13 CEOs in the Fortune 500 are women. So that's one big difference. Most of them are from one side of the Atlantic or the other. most of the new ones, though, are being created in Asia. Most of the people are someplace else. So that's another problem. About 60% of them are from the private sector. And maybe most strikingly, about a third of them went to one of 20 universities. So, you know, they're going through the same funnel. The networks are starting to be formed early. And one of the things that you find with a system like that, with a process like that, is that they tend to have more in common with one another than they do the people in the countries that they come from.
Despite the fact that they may have a great deal of leverage to control the way you and I live, the kinds of things that are available to us, the kinds of laws that are ultimately made, they may not have necessarily be in touch with the way regular people live.
Well, that's right. I mean, I define this group in terms of its influence, as opposed to, you know, they don't rule the world. But if they want an outcome and you want an outcome, even though you have a TV show, they're going to have more influence than you or I is.
Isn't that ruling the world?
Well, it's certainly having the better hand. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, these people have a hugely disproportionately better hand. This, you know, there are, you know, 1,100 billionaires in the world, and most of them meet the grade here. You know, they're the people who run the biggest companies. There are 250 companies in the world that have annual sales that equal a third of global GDP. So they're really, really big players. And they get their way more often than not.
So you mentioned those 20 universities. I'm imagining parents wanting to go look this up. And is the superclass something that people can aspire to, or is it sort of a birthright in some cases?
Well, you know, 100 years ago, the answer would be birthright. You know, it's tied to inheritance, tied to land. And one of the things that's changed is, you know, two-thirds, in some cases more, of the people who make it into this group are self-made. And that's different. But you know, to go then to the next leap and to think, well, we finally come to a meritocracy, and if you're good, you get to the top. Well, that's just not true, because if you're a woman, the odds are against you. If you're born in a different part of the world, the odds are against you. If you can't afford to go to one of those universities, the odds are against you. And everywhere you see that even as this group changes, inequality grows. And so there are more and more people who are left behind, even in the United States. In the United States, if you're born in the bottom 60% of the population, you've only got a 1 in 20 chance of making it up into the top 10.
Despite the fact that socially, theoretically, we have no restrictions on that.
Right. Well, there's social mobility, but, you know, there's a predisposition. And you know that if you're born in an inner city, the likelihood that you're going to finish high school or that you're going to go to college is much lower than if you're born someplace else. And, you know, there are other manifestations of inequality that, you know, I mean, an affluent white woman in the world lives 14 years longer than a poor black man. So, you know, they've even got more elbow room to play with, you know, if you're within this affluent group. But the problem comes as the few at the top grow farther and farther away from the many at the bottom. And just as one illustration of the growing inequality, the 1,100 billionaires have a net worth that's roughly twice that of the 2.5 billion poorest people on Earth. So the few at the very, very top are living in a completely different world from the vast majority of people on the planet.
Now, we know that some of these folks, for example, people like Bill Gates and Bono, and I guess if you want to expand it out, the Pope, are involved in philanthropic activities. Is it sort of a prerequisite of being part of this class that people take an interest in something beyond acquisition of their own wealth?
Well, I wouldn't say it's prerequisite. Actually, it's kind of an exception to the rule. I mean, you know, to get to the very, very top, you know, you've got to not be satisfied with the first billion. You know, you've got to go to the second. You've got to not be satisfied with being a senator. You want to be a president. And that means you tend to be very self-interested, you know, often monomaniacal, really pushing forward towards that. Some people in this group are just wired differently, or they achieve a different, you know, level. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett say, well, I'm going to give back all of my fortune. But they're the exception. You know, if you look at the very, very wealthy in the world, the average contribution they make to charity is 1%, not 90 or 100%.
So the other thing that's very striking is that these people tend to run in the same circles. They see each other at the same kinds of meetings. Can you talk about what sorts of events these are where they run into each other?
Well, I mean, a classic example is the World Economic Forum in Davos, where people every year go to Switzerland from business and from political world. It's only a couple thousand people. It's certainly not this whole group. You're not going to see Osama bin Laden on the ski slopes. But it does help form the network. It does help you understand what other people are thinking. And, you know, that's another really big source of power these people have. It's not just the power to, you know, make decisions over their organizations or influence politics. It's the power to set the agenda. If I meet you at Davos and I say, well, gee, she's thinking this and, you know, she's pretty smart, so maybe I ought to think that, and then we both go back to our relative companies or countries and say, well, here's what it really looks like. That starts to shape what the world, you know, has as its, you know, top priorities and the solutions that we tend to be looking towards. And so the Davoses of this world and some of the sectoral meetings that you see, and they're regional ones. I mean, Carlos Slim in Mexico has a fathers and sons meeting, which gets the heads of the biggest companies and their kids together so that they talk about succession and the future. There are meetings like this in Asia. The Chinese have started one in a small island off the coast called the Bo Ao Forum, and they're trying to do a kind of a Davos themselves. There are always meetings like this. I think sometimes the conspiracy theorists kind of think, well, you know, something really special is going on behind the scenes there, and they're in a room deciding what all our futures will be. That doesn't happen there. But what's really happening is just as interesting. Networks are forming, common views are being shaped, and these people are getting to more and more like each other, more like a little village, and less like the countries and the villages they came from.
Well, to the extent that they're powered by globalized wealth, and they operate at a sort of super governmental level because their power is mainly economic, it is sort of discouraging to hear this and to think, well, what do we do? Do we as consumers have any ability to influence the way these people operate?
Well, look, there are a lot of kinds of influence that you might have, you know, whether it's choosing to buy one thing or another or investing one way or another. But the traditional balance that we've always had against the most empowered and particularly against them abusing that great power is government. And government tends to work within a national level. And if we start to say, well, we need global governance mechanisms, the immediate reaction in any country in the world is, well, you're out of the debate, because that's the third rail in politics. We're not going to cede our sovereignty upward. But the problem is there are too many transnational issues, whether it's proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or trade or regulating global financial markets or climate change, and the list goes on and on and on, that you can't solve at the national level. You need something effective at the international level, and most of the institutions we have at the international level are really weak or dysfunctional. They don't work, and so we have to come up with something better. And yet, we can't have the debate. We can't even talk about it in polite society. And that's a real challenge for our time, is sort of getting comfortable with the fact that if you preserve sovereignty, what you're giving up is democracy. You're giving up the balance that the average citizen has against the collective, collaborative power of, you know, some of these people from this super elite.
Well, do you think that a structure like the EU lays the groundwork for possibly at least having this debate in open ground at some point?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the evolution of the EU is a perfect example of how people from a group of countries that spent 1,000 years fighting with each other said, we need to operate at a higher level. It's in our interest. It also gave them a competitive advantage economically because they became a big market instead of a lot of small markets, and markets love scale, and investment, you know, starts to flow in as a result of that. The EU still can't make foreign policy. The EU is still a big bureaucracy. It's still ineffective. And I think what some critics do is they focus on what's not working and they don't focus on where progress is being made. But the EU is a mechanism. There are other international mechanisms that work okay. They just need to work better. And we just have to realize that in the toolbox, you wouldn't do without a city government, state government, and a national government. But there's a missing level if you want to deal with some of the big issues of our time.
So the superclass now is largely made up of white males over 40. Now that we're seeing much more wealth and power flowing from Asia, do you think as the makeup of the superclass changes, will its priorities change? Will the dynamics change within that group?
Almost inevitably. And, you know, I mean, Asia creates more billionaires than anywhere else. Asia creates more billion-dollar-plus companies than anywhere else right now. And the Asian view is different. And if, you know, it was a European group, it came from a European tradition, which is kind of a proselytizing tradition, let's change the world to be like us, that's not the Asian tradition. The Asian tradition is kind of live and let live. If you and I can do business together, great. And if you are abusing your people at home, I'm just not going to get into that because I consider that to be your domestic lookout. Well, if that became the prevailing view of the elites of the world, how different would international relations be? If other value changes took place at the highest level, how differently would companies be run? How differently would we look at the role of the community versus the role of the individual? There are a lot of things we can talk about in this book where we can influence the outcome. I think that's one where those changes are going to happen whether we like it or not.
What signs would tell you that things are moving in the right direction?
Well, it's different for everybody. To me, what you look for in society is better lives for people. You look for a balance between peace and prosperity. I think for the past 30 years, there's been a very heavy focus on markets, and the metric that we've been using is, society is working if it creates more wealth. But, is that overall wealth or wealth for everybody? And what we've seen is that the top part of every society has grown farther from the bottom. Middle classes have shrunk. The gap between rich countries and poor countries has grown. And to me, that kind of inequality both creates political tension, and it's wrong. It's wrong that 3 billion people on Earth live on less than $2 a day. It's wrong that most of them have never heard a dial tone. It's wrong that most of them don't have a shot at this. And it's wrong to say, here's our system. We're going to offer you the chance to grow, be patient, and in 5 generations, you too can live like us. Because that's, the deal is, stick with this, and you'll have benefits after you die. And that's
not
just
worth the wait.
It's certainly not worth the wait, and it's not equitable. And I think we have to sort of stop every so often and say, where's the justice in our society? What is the shape of the global society that we want to have, and how do we get there?
David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The book is called Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. Just ahead on Think, Josh Allen Friedman on the dirty world of blues and rock and roll. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes a Britcom bonanza, A Planet in Peril, and Musings on a Blank Canvas. At the Rosemarine Theater in Fort Worth, The Butterfly Connection brings you the 1999 Tony Award winner for Best Play, Art, a complex look at friendship, truth, and what qualifies as art. The Flower Mound Performing Arts Theater presents the premiere of Project Youth, a futuristic musical exploration of the Earth's extinction, with performances from actors from the theater's Young Artist Training Program. Dallas's Haley Henman Gallery opens their newest exhibit, God's Hands, featuring the colorfully explosive works from local mixed media and abstract artist Joshua Stone. And for the fans of Dead Parrots, Lumberjacks, and Spam, the British Emporium and Palace Art Center in Grapevine go full on loony this weekend with the Monty Python Madness Charity Festival, 3 days of Python sketches, costume contests, and much more. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
How well do you know the history of the music you love? In a new book called Tell the Truth Until They Bleed, Coming Clean in the Dirty World of Blues and Rock and Roll, Josh Allen Friedman busts myths and establishes some legends about an industry which is every bit as wild and surprising as the art it produces. Josh, welcome to Think.
Welcome.
There's a lot of focus in the book about songwriters, which it's very interesting because typically they're not household words, they're not famous people, and yet they've put together songs that virtually every American has memorized.
Well, the featured attraction of this book being Lieber and Stoller are one of the greatest songwriting teams of the 20th century, and they're still just babies. They're only 75 years old. But they wrote Hound Dog when they were 19 years old. They're not household names because you wouldn't want them in your house. But in their house, however, they're a pleasure to be with. They're just a gas to hang out with. And particularly Jerry Lieber, who I think invented rock and roll as much as any other man that ever lived. It wouldn't be here without him.
Tell us some of the songs that he wrote. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, the list goes on and on. Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Stand By Me, On Broadway, all the Coasters output, like Charlie Brown, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Is That All There Is for Peggy Lee, Kansas City, songs that have been recorded, songs that are landmarks and that are on the tip of everybody's tongue 50 years after they were first recorded. Of course, in the 1950s, the songwriters that I'm dealing with here, like Lieber and Stoller, Doc Pomus, thought that their songs were just for the moment, and it was just junk they were writing for teenagers. They were even ashamed of their own work. And they all looked up to the Broadway composers, like Julie Stein and Sammy Kahn or Kurt Weill, you know, as being their heroes. And, of course, someone like Ira Gershwin, who Lieber and Stoller would have hung out with, loathed rock and roll. So they never received their tidal waves of recognition until many, many years later, and thankfully learned to appreciate that they wrote, their work was genius.
And in fact, they weren't paid often, or they sold away their rights pretty easily. And in Lieber and Stoller's case, I guess, had their rights extorted from them.
Yes, well, the untold story that they still are very hesitant to talk about, and they're paranoid 45 years later, but their music operation in the Brill Building called Redbird Music was strong-armed, muscled away from them in the 60s by the mob in Times Square. Now, today, everything is corporate. You can't strong-arm Time Warner, you know, or Universal. But in the 50s and 60s, Lieber and Stoller were just two guys. They may have been writing a hit a week, more than a hit a week, writing and producing from the Brill Building, but they were just two guys in an office. So some guy named Sally Meatballs could walk in off the street and practically hold a gun to their head and have them sign away publishing rights. In fact, they were chased out of the business for 3 years. And that whole story, which has never been told, I have that for the first time featured in this book, how the mob moved in on some of the music business in the 60s.
Jerry Lieber thought that Elvis ruined Hound Dog.
Yes. It was originally written for Big Mama Thornton, who was a 6-foot-tall, 300-pound blues shouter. And it was about a no-good sponger, a guy who just takes advantage of his woman, and she throws him out of the house. And all of a sudden, the lyrics were changed. When they heard it several years later, recorded by Elvis, Jerry Lieber was very, very upset and wanted to sue the first time he heard Elvis's version of Hound Dog, because it corrupted the lyrics and actually was about a hound dog. You know, Elvis sang it to a bloodhound on the Steve Allen Show and ruined the intent of the song. And to this day, Jerry Lieber can't listen to it. Even though it sold 8 million copies, he decided not to sue eventually and just accepted it, but he can't even listen to his own song.
From the comforts of the giant beach house.
in California. He prefers not to hear it. It still gets him very upset 50 years later.
What's a ponce, Josh, and how did you become one?
Well, I wrote my first Kiss and Tell. I've never done that before. And it's a little embarrassing to talk about, but I exercised the demons on paper here in a story about Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. When I was very young, and she was much younger, I became... the derogatory term would be a ponce, who's like the guy who runs to the cleaners and gets the sequin gown to give to the girls before they go on stage and carries their luggage, and just became not her gopher. I was her boyfriend, but it was a degrading experience in my life with this poor woman who was, by the time she was 20 years old, she was thrown onto the oldies bus and was forever after called an oldies act, because she peaked when she was 17 with songs like Be My Baby and Walking in the Rain. So I call that chapter Mr. Nobody.
Do you think, you know, there are some crazy new Phil Spector stories in here as well. Do you think that the music industry attracts people who are already a little different than everybody else, or does it somehow make them a little crazy?
Both, probably. I mean, you're going to be the natural state for any professional musician, practically anyone who's going to do that for their career they're going to go insane. You know, almost any artist, whether they're a serious writer, musician, or songwriter, and spend their lifetime in that business, they're going to go insane. So when you have people who were insane to begin with, and then they go into the music business, forget about it. You might as well just like write them off to Creedmoor.
And very quickly, what are your favorite places these days in North Texas to go hear live music?
Well, I still love Sons of Herman Hall and Poor David's and Uncle Calvin's. I'm tending to stay out of the bars lately. You know, I think I played, as a guitar player myself, I estimated I did between 3,000 and 5,000 nights in nightclubs and bars, and started thinking, maybe that's enough.
So, sounds good. Probably good for your health, too. Josh, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
The book is called Tell the Truth Until They Bleed, Coming Clean in the Dirty World of Blues and Rock and Roll. You can download free video and audio podcasts of this show on our newly renovated website, kera.org/think. Our email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.